Well, it's my first trip to Canada, and I'll do my best to try to keep you awake after that delicious lunch. I will try to keep to the time limit to not cause the program to go over. I'd like to talk to you about some work that I've been doing in sort of character motion synthesis. But I guess, like everybody at CMU in the graphics group right now, I happily sit on the fence between robotics and graphics. So I'll be showing you pictures of humanoid robots. After I left Stanford, I actually went to University of Tokyo for 2 years and was working on writing some control software and motion planning for the robots there. And it turns out that trying to control sort of a humanoid shape in the physical world shares a lot in common, although there are some differences between trying to control sort of a complex kinematic and dynamic object in the virtual world. So just to briefly mention, the things I'll show you have been the result of some collaborations I've been doing with these people in Japan and people in my advisor, Jean-Claude at Stanford, and my colleague at the University of Illinois, Stephen Laval, and people in the graphics group at CMU. I'll show you maybe at the end some preliminary work that's sort of half-baked that we're sort of thinking about to hopefully open up a discussion. Before I start, I guess I have to start with the obligatory video of a humanoid robot. So last March, we developed this humanoid. It's about 55 kilograms when you add in the extra batteries and things. But it has four sensors on the feet and also six-axis force sensors. So it uses that as in a feedback to make sure that the motion is stable. We generate dynamic trajectories, but of course these are modified online as it encounters any disturbances. And it's joystick driven. You can just sort of move it where you want to go. And then I'll talk a little bit later in the talk about how it's very polite too. This is a very Japanese robot. That's my advisor in Tokyo, Professor Inoue. And this robot can climb stairs. It actually has an interesting feature that I'll talk about is the toe joint there can flex. So it actually allowed this robot to sort of hold the world record right now in stair climbing. So it actually, this is a 25-centimeter stair that it's able to climb. And then I think we have a close-up video of you can see that the toe, basically the flexion of the toe allows the trailing foot to stay on the ground a little bit longer, so it can actually stably climb pretty high steps. And then, sure. It's probably an accent. I think he's pretty symmetric. We just mirror the trajectories if we want him to climb with the right. But anyway, yeah, you can sequence them. So, but I think a lot of people have come to the realization that modeling physical systems shares a lot in common with these other areas: robotics, computer vision, computer graphics, computational geometry. Carlo Tomasi used to say that graphics is the inverse of vision. In vision, you film the real world and you try to build a model. In graphics, you do the opposite. You have a model, you try to make an image. So everything sort of shares the common link of computational geometry and model building and in robotics and in control for animation. So I was working on this simulation environment where you could sort of, specify a very simple text file that would describe the kinematics and dynamic properties, and then you could interactively sort of move around and play with a virtual robot. And then later I'll show you some examples where this has been used to do sort of interactive character animation. So here you can sort of simulate, what the robot or what the virtual robot or the character can see in the environment and do some processing. So a quick overview of my talk, the way I sort of structured things, was I'll talk a little bit about character animation and in particular sort of representing motion and viewing it as a high-dimensional sort of search problem. And then talk about motion planning in robotics and then how we can map some of those technologies to character animation, and in particular for two tasks, for navigation and for manipulation planning. And then sort of new stuff, how to actually bring in some dynamics and physics into the process, and also maybe help the planning process be informed, or your search process be a little smarter by sort of leveraging data, because now we've got all these motion capture databases. And I hope that this will stimulate some discussion and some interesting interactions between everyone here. Just to make the distinction, everybody knows you've got offline characters, a lot of hard work, a lot of amazing skill and talent that goes into sort of animating these things, and then you've got sort of interactive online things. The techniques I'm talking about now are sort of in a stage where they're probably acceptable for if you can make them interactive, because the quality of the motion is not really as expressive enough to get what you need for offline animation. It could be maybe a rapid prototyping tool, but really the target here is trying to get interactive things. Things computers do well. I think at least the classical sort of Turing machine model, you've got arithmetic and search. You know, you've got this thing that can produce, you know, gigaflops of calculations, and it also it can has a huge memory, so you can systematically explore many discrete possibilities. That's why computers can play chess well. I mean, people were thinking, oh gosh, you know, humanity should feel bad that, you know, Kasparov lost or something. But really, I mean, if something's exploring 500 billion chess boards a second, I mean, everybody would probably feel like they'd lose. So. And then recently, I believe that the things computers can do well is actually visual display. Now we've got really a second processor that can do matrix multiplies. You've got pixel shaders. I believe the latest graphics cards, the GPUs, are actually Turing complete, so you can really have a parallel machine sort of sitting on your desktop. And the memory bandwidth between the GPU and the main CPU is huge. You know, you have gigabytes per second. So how can you leverage sort of the things that computers do well and then try to talk about you know, high-dimensional search? So you have this human model of its kinematics, its dynamics, and some appearance, and then you have sort of the environment that this character is situated in, and then you have some kind of simulation that will produce some motion, whether it's joint trajectories or some skin deformation, some hair and clothing simulations. And the problem, as a lot of people, previous speakers pointed out, was how do you really control the simulation to get what you want? How do you program this? Or how do you write something that will be able to control a character that's autonomous or in an interactive environment like a game? So, you know, we want sort of a motion that does not need to be explicitly defined by the user, and then ultimately we'd like to have sort of, you know, virtual robots, you know, agents that can exist in virtual worlds and behave intelligently. So people use different, you know, terms to describe this. So thinking about character motion, there's obviously some problems with representing characters in sort of the joint space and you know, sort of the way robotics has generally defined sort of kinematics. You know, the human body is much more complex, especially the shoulder joint or the back, the spine. But traditionally, this is sort of how people have represented character motion. You can think of this curve in this high-dimensional space, a point representing sort of a pose of the character, and then a curve that's time parameterized will represent some motion. And clearly, it's an interesting question that came up. You know, how much information do you need to sort of span the space of usable human motion? Clearly, if you look at all the possible curves in this space, it's huge. And if you're trying to synthesize motion, then the question is, how do you build a good enough model that the curves that you create in this space actually do something useful, or like get the character to do what you want it, or look aesthetic. And just for reference, these are sort of the HANIM standard for the high resolution and low resolution standard human models. The low resolution model has sort of 19 parts, sort of like the thigh, the calf, and then the degrees of freedom are 68, so they actually tried to model some of the spine degrees of freedom. And then basically the 50 extra degrees of freedom for the high resolution model is essentially the hands, each hand taking 25 degrees of freedom. So in robotics, this notion of the joint space has been called the configuration space. It's been a popular method of specifying for sort of kinematic chains. You know, here's an initial posture of a robot, and you want it to pick something up. Here's a goal posture. Then the problem of motion planning was, how do you actually calculate a curve in this space to connect one posture to the other posture, because this space obviously is going to have some constraints on the motion. Just to give you an example that this space is complicated even for two dimensions. Look, this is probably the simplest case you can think of, just a little two-link robot. So here, if I sort of map the angles, theta 1 and theta 2, in this plane. Now, clearly the topology here is actually a torus, because those things sort of wrap around, right? But I'm sort of cutting the torus and sort of unfolding it and making it into this 2D sheet. And the incredible thing is these sort of simple obstacles actually map to these very sort of complex shapes here in the configuration space. So there isn't really a good representation or a way to represent these configuration space obstacles, as they're called. These are sort of obstacles in the workspace. These are obstacles in the configuration space. And you can see sort of a path, let's say, going from position 1 to configuration 2. You could go this way to get there, or you could actually sort of go along here and wrap around and reach that space. So that would correspond to a different motion here in the joint space there. So for low dimensions, basically, this map was computed simply by sampling, sort of discretely storing what the configuration space obstacles look like. And then you can do planning in this low-dimensional space. And I'll talk about later, what happens when you have this 68-degree of freedom humanoid. Then, mapping and representing these complicated obstacles in the configuration space becomes unreasonable. So the problem statement of path planning or motion planning, path planning is distinguished from motion planning in the sense that a path only considers the kinematics. So we're just looking for a continuous sequence of configurations, sort of connecting some initial pose to a goal pose. If you say motion planning, usually people are talking about, well, now you've got some time parameterization. So you've got, some animation, some ease in or ease out, or minimum jerk or something that's actually producing some time parameterization. The input will be the environment obstacles. You get the kinematics of the robot, virtual or real, and then some initial and goal configurations, and the planner will, the goal is to compute some continuous sequence that'll connect the start and the goal while avoiding these obstacles. So for a humanoid, clearly if you're doing navigation planning, so we'll look at one instance, let's say you want to give this interactive character, let's say it's an AI in your game, some high-level task, walk over to the bookshelf, you can extract, so one method of sort of solving this problem of high-dimensional spaces, don't plan in the full joint space, just sort of think about what are the relevant degrees of freedom that are important for this navigation task. So clearly, if you think of this guy as like an oriented cylinder, you can plan for essentially an oriented disk or an oriented cylinder here in this space, and then use walking data or motion capture data to animate the other joints, which is what I'll show you how that works. So for navigation planning, the configuration space was popularized by Lozano Perez at MIT, actually a little more than 20 years ago. And the idea was that, well, let's see, if you've got two disks and you want to move this disk around, you can actually shrink the disk to a point and just expand the obstacles by the radius of the disk, and then all of a sudden your problem just becomes sort of planning for a point. So you can do that pretty quickly and run your standard sort of graph search algorithm, which is used in games a lot, the sort of pathfinding in games, where you discretely represent the free regions and the obscured or obstructed regions of your space, and then use A star, Dijkstra's algorithm, or best first search, or whatever your favorite search algorithm is, to actually calculate a path. So here, this shows Dijkstra's algorithm, calculating sort of an optimal path according to the metric in this maze. And once you have sort of the motion, sort of the gross motion of the body, then you have some motion capture data. And anybody who's ever used sort of motion capture data, especially for games, knows that one of the best things you can do to sort of pre-process the data is compute sort of what they call the treadmill frame of reference. You have sort of the data initially sort of with respect to the world. You sort of split up the transformation of the world to the hip into two transformations, one relative to a point that sort of moves at constant velocity along the direction of the motion. And I think I have an example here of one that's computed. So here, this is actually 16 frames of, or 25 frames of walking data, and you've got the treadmill frame, which is the base point here. So the base point here, we'll make a simple little tracker that will actually follow the path, and I think it'll show here in a minute. So initially I started doing this to try to control mobile robots, and then eventually had it sort of control animated characters. So got this robot here, and it's in this maze. I can sort of click on this this goal here. This is sort of the goal, and then just sort of drag it around, and it updates the path dynamically. It doesn't do any pre-processing, so I can actually click on walls and move them around, and it'll update sort of a path. And then I can get this guy to actually build sort of a model based on vision. So I can sort of simulate what this guy sees and then have it act according to, you know, its perception. So you bring perception in the loop. It tries to always, at any instant, follow what it thinks is the best path to the goal. But clearly, as it sort of discovers new obstacles, it updates it and then replans a path. And this was used initially to try to, you know, get the robot to avoid getting stuck in sort of local minima, in the sense that if you use sort of a simple sort of reactive-based sort of goal, you know, potential field method, you can get stuck in local minima. But this planner actually is complete in the sense that it will, you know, keep a history of where it's gone and what it's seen. But here's using it with the motion capture data. I can sort of try to frustrate this guy. Moving walls around, I can move his goal around, and then he'll just keep, you know, trying to track it and replan where he wants to go. And then once you have it defined for one character, it turns out you can use the same map to do planning for multiple characters, and you can have characters plan around each other. In this example, I've got one character that's under user control. He's sort of the guy running in the middle. And then these other characters and robots are instructed to follow other characters. So you just sort of update their goal dynamically. And so you can get sort of many characters sort of planning and around each other and, in the same environment interactively. So another task I'll take a look at is sort of object manipulation tasks. So here, let's say I want to move this object from here to here. And I want to somehow synthesize the arm motions to do that. Now, if I were doing it, let's say, from here to here, I'd have to be careful not to bump, you know, this obstacle here. And there's been a lot of work in sort of robotics and sort of motion planning and trying to, you know, do configuration space planning. But it turns out that these methods where you can explicitly represent your environment in the 2D case don't work for high dimensions. So you have to do something different. So let's, for the simple case, just simplify the kinematics of a human arm. And usually it's represented by 3 degrees of freedom, 3 at the shoulder, 1 at the elbow, and 3 at the wrist. And now you've got this 7-dimensional C space if you want to sort of plan a manipulation motion for a fixed shoulder position. So there's different ways to sort of simplify this search problem. The navigation case, the solution was, well, we're going to project the search to some lower dimensional space and sort of plan using the degrees of freedom which are most important for the task. You can also sort of limit the number of possibilities. It's interesting, usually when people think, well, if I add constraints to a problem, it'll get more complicated because I have more calculations. And sometimes it turns out that adding constraints reduces sort of the number of possibilities that you have to examine. So there's sort of a trade-off in the sense of, you know, reducing the number of possibilities you have to consider, and then sort of the cost of checking all your constraints. And usually another way to simplify the problem is, so in the 2D case, we could get optimal paths using A-star, Dijkstra's algorithm. If you have a 7-dimensional space, A-star will run forever. So you sort of sacrifice optimality. And then the other thing you sacrifice is the completeness, and I'll say a little bit more about that, what's done in heuristic planning. So in high dimensions, there's been a lot of work in this area in robotics. I won't cover everything in detail, but the idea is usually the planning is sort of broken up into two classes, where you have sort of a single query case where you've got, let's say, obstacles that could be changing. So you just want to know what is one path from a start to a goal. The multiple query case is where you're going to do many queries in the same environment. So you sort of pre-process it. You spend a lot of time sort of trying to build up some graph structure or some representation of the whole space, of the free space, and then keep that in memory so you can do quick planning just by searching the graph. So when I was just starting out as a master's student, I worked on this project that was at SIGGRAPH. This was actually, somehow the time coding's a little wrong. It's too fast. But this was like the last, I believe, the last thing in analog media that was submitted to the Electronic Theater and shown at the Electronic Theater in SIGGRAPH 94. Unfortunately, I don't know why the time coding's a little screwed up there. But the idea was that all these motions here for the robot and the human were generated automatically. There was no keyframing and no motion capture or anything. The idea was that you just specify at a task level, so that you'd say, I want you to move the pawn from here to here, and then the motion to grab it and move it was synthesized. We learned some things about that this wasn't really good enough for offline animation, but could be acceptable if you could do it interactively. So then, that planner in 1994 took 5 to 10 minutes to generate an arm motion. So I spent sort of my thesis time working on trying to make it interactive. My roommate used to joke that, well, if you just, stay long enough, eventually it'll be interactive. But I needed to graduate. So I started to look at this problem more fundamentally from a mathematical point of view. So the ideal case is we build what we call a complete motion planner. A complete motion planner means that if there's a path, this algorithm will find it. And if there's no path, it will terminate in finite time and tell you that there is no path. And the problem is that this is shown to be p-space hard, and the computation time grows exponentially in terms of the number of dimensions that you're searching. So heuristic algorithms usually sacrifice completeness. So that means that if there's a path that exists, with high probability it will find it. But if the algorithm just keeps running, you won't be able to know whether or not there is no path. It'll just keep trying and trying and trying, and there might actually be no path for it to find. So in particular, I worked on this method with my colleague at the University of Illinois, Steve LaValle. We developed sort of a search technique called rapidly exploring random trees. And there's some very interesting properties about this tree. I just show you an animation of a 2D tree that's being grown. So it starts out with a single point, and incrementally grows a tree. Now, if you look sort of at the way it grows, it turns out that in the beginning it sort of rapidly expands out to sort of the unexplored regions. But as the number of iterations increases, it eventually sort of covers the space uniformly, which turns out to have some really nice properties for motion planning, in the sense that you'll rapidly try to sort of branch out and cover large volumes of your search space without exploring all the neighbors around you. But you won't get sort of trapped in one part of the space, because eventually the tree will sort of cover uniformly any non-convex space. And I just want to show you how that works. So one of the intuitions actually about how these things work is, if you look at sort of the Voronoi diagram of a tree here, so these are the Voronoi regions of each of the nodes in this little tree that's starting to grow. You'll sample this space, and the probability of sampling, or if you sample it uniformly, the probability of sampling one of the big regions is proportional to its area. So the algorithm will essentially be biased to split large Voronoi regions into smaller and smaller regions, till in the limiting case you basically get sort of uniformly sized Voronoi regions. So how does this work? It's actually amazingly simple. You start with just some initial node in your tree, and you do this iteration where you generate a sample, let's say uniformly in your space. So I'll pick a sample point here, and then just try to grow the tree toward that sample. Okay, and if it hits an obstacle, I just go to the next iteration. If I'm able to actually connect a branch, then I add it to the tree and then repeat this. And it turns out, so you start out with, let's say, an existing tree. You pick a sample. You calculate the nearest node from this sample point to the point in the tree. This means that this implicitly assumes that you have to define some kind of distance metric. So for 2D, you can use, let's say, a Euclidean metric to figure out what is the nearest neighbor of this node. So that'll be the node that you'll try to grow the tree, extend the tree from. And then if you're successful, you'll add a new node to the tree. And if you do this simple thing over and over, you basically get that, which is kind of interesting. So how does this help you actually do manipulation planning? It turns out if you just grow a tree, it doesn't give you a planner. But to get a planner to solve an actual query, you can actually grow two trees. So here, I'll show you this maze example. I've got a start and a goal here, and I'm growing two trees, and then eventually when they, as soon as they share a node in common, then you have a path. So the way that works here, sort of diagrammatically, we've got two trees, one grown from the start, one grown from the goal. If we add a node to one tree, that becomes the target of the other tree. So you sort of calculate the nearest neighbor. This is the nearest neighbor. You make an extension and then add a node. And there's some optimizations we made to actually, if you successfully add a small branch, you can sort of keep iterating and in a greedy fashion and try to get a connection as quick as possible. And this was used to solve this classic benchmark in motion planning that no other algorithm had solved before this. This is a six-dimensional problem called the alpha puzzle, if anybody's seen this. The first algorithm to actually solve this in software, a motion path, to unhook these two rings. Turns out that there's a very, very tight, narrow corridor in the six-dimensional space because there's very carefully the motions have to be coordinated to actually translate and rotate simultaneously and remove those two rings. So just briefly, some analysis of this planner. So here's a theorem. Xk will be the probability distribution, or sort of the distribution of nodes in your tree, and x will be your sampling distribution. So our claim is that the vertex distribution at iteration k will converge towards your sampling distribution. And the intuition, the way you can sort of intuitively think about why that's true, is that as your tree grows, eventually every sample point that's collision-free that you check will be added to the tree. Okay. So, yeah, as it sort of reaches out all over the free configuration space, the probability that the random sample or the sample that you choose immediately becomes a new vertex approaches one. And then we have some work on sort of figuring out the rate of convergence, and you know, it's hard to actually come up with a real rigorous mathematical definition, but we do have some results showing that the probability that you find a path, if one exists, will increase exponentially with the number of iterations. Just as a sort of teaser image, I'm sort of working on sort of my spare time. I do ray tracing and I do like art. And it turns out that I've been looking recently at some fractal properties of these trees. So I rendered this image using POV ray, and it's just grown from a base here. I just started a sample point and sampled a 3D volume and grew this tree. And it almost looks sort of natural in some sort of gnarly way. But and then I sort of made the thickness proportional to sort of the furthest node of its descendant, so the distance of its furthest descendant. That's still sort of work that's kind of half-baked, but there are some interesting sort of fractal properties of these search trees. Actually, what we did do is we actually did what happens if you sample an infinite plane? How many branches do you get? It turns out that if you sample an infinite plane, you get three branches always, sort of going out sort of 120 degrees. And then in three dimensions, it sort of turns out to be sort of tetrahedral. You get four branches, sort of branching out where, like, if you had a tetrahedron and you started at the center, you'd have a branch sort of going out towards all the vertices of the tetrahedron. So there are some things that we've done, but we haven't actually tried doing some. Yeah. Really good idea. Yeah, thanks. So yeah, we haven't done that yet, but yeah, there are some interesting things that are fun to look at. So the idea was, well, we have this efficient way of searching these high-dimensional spaces. How can we actually use it to animate something? So the idea was, well, you know, let's say we had a task where the character had to move a bottle from, say, here to here. So the first, it would plan a motion sort of to reach and grab the object, And then once it did the grab, it would plan another motion to sort of transfer it to the new location. Once it put it there, it would release it, and then plan another motion to bring the arm back to rest. And we did some work on trying to sort of get a good sort of fast inverse kinematics algorithms for humans. So we looked into sort of the biomechanics and neurophysiology literature, and they had this sensory motor transform where they took a whole bunch of human subjects and gave them pointing tasks. And then they just recorded all that data and just did a sort of least squares fit. And so, you know, using these this little model here, we got some pretty, you know, good-looking sort of natural postures for mapping sort of the six-dimensional orientation and rotation into sort of the 7 degrees of freedom of the human arm. So for one fixed position orientation, you've got this redundancy here. The elbow can be positioned in many places. You want to select a natural one. So I'll just show you this this video, see if it starts playing. So here's the testing out the inverse kinematics. Sort of, you can, you know, click on it and drag around, and then I had simple sort of gaze inverse kinematics for the eyes and the head. Turns out that really improved the results a lot. It looked really horrible if he just sort of stood there looking off blankly into space. But you know, so you got really, you know, pretty good performance on this thing. And then you could sort of connect it with the path planner. So I was trying to make basically the interactive version of that movie that I had at the Electronic Theater in 1994. So I could just click on a piece and then say go, and then it would just figure out how to move the arm. So it's actually executing the planner three times sort of interactively in that situation. I can just move a piece, and it will move, you know, avoiding obstacles and avoiding collisions with itself as well. And it works for both arms, too.
Is this one done with the
roadmap? Actually, it's the rapidly exploring random tree that I just showed you, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So the smoothing, I kind of left out that detail. That's a good point. But yeah, you get this sort of jerky path, but it turns out sort of like a string. You're sort of pulling the slack on a string. Like once you have a path, there's like really easy ways you can use to just sort of pull it. And later on, I'll talk about dynamics where that's not true. And when you have sort of dynamic constraints, you can't do that. But because we're sort of doing a kinematic path, it didn't matter. And then, Right. So it's a really kind of very, you know, simple model. It was just a first pass at this, really. I mean, and the motion quality is, you know, not nearly good enough for something like, you know, alpha and animation, but if you could get it in games or get, you know, interactive characters, it might be good enough. So here's actually a complicated case where you have to put this hammer sort of inside this housing, avoiding all the collisions and stuff. But yeah, it, right now, and this model is simplistic in the sense that, you know, it's just looking at the 7 degrees of freedom of the arm. It's not considering, you know, the shoulder and how it could move those additional torso degrees of freedom. That's what I started looking at. I sort of graduated finally, and then I went to Japan and started working on humanoid robots. And then we started thinking, well, how can we actually coordinate all the degrees of freedom of this 30 degree of freedom mechanism? And we have all these additional constraints. And originally, I thought it was going to be harder. It turns out, you know, because you have these additional constraints, you sort of restrict much more seriously the configurations you have to consider. So here, let's say these are the obstacles that in the configuration space. And you've got this initial pose and goal pose. And here, I'm showing two dimensions, but you have to sort of think in 30 dimensions. But then a huge volume of the space is completely invalid poses, where things where the robot will fall down, right? The balance constraints will be violated. And what you want is you want a trajectory that will, you know, connect these two poses, be collision-free, including self-collision, and then also be dynamically stable. So you want something that sort of satisfies all the constraints and will get you there. So we started working on this this auto balancer. So here in this movie, this is a little puppet, sort of like one of those monkeys. And the input is a non-dynamically stable configuration, but the output is dynamically stable. You can see he's just sort of balancing there. So we sort of looked at how can we filter this motion, make it dynamically stable. So he moved quickly, but then we sort of filtered it so that it tries to keep balanced. And it turns out it's sort of a local optimization problem. So if your filter is fast enough, then you can use the previous solution as your initial guess and then sort of locally sort of optimize to satisfy all the constraints. So here you can switch to two legs mode. There's a little button there. Now, you know, you can sort of move the robot around and have it sort of balance on two legs. And the interesting thing about this is because it has feedback from the sensors on the foot, it doesn't matter if the thing's tilting, right? Because it's just using the local feedback to actually keep the thing balanced. Okay. So this is kind of a fun video to watch. So this was sort of the little robot, the safe robot, that we used to test our algorithms before we ran it on the big one. So here, yeah, he switched back to one leg mode. He can still balance on one leg even on this big incline. So here, trying to get this thing to kick a ball. Obviously, we use these little cheap servos. This is a really inexpensive robot. Sony has an amazing one. If anybody's seen Sony's new robot, so it has a little vision tracker on it and can try to kick the ball. But the actuators were pretty limited and it was very simple. But we still could sort of get some interesting motions.
Is it sensing gravity?
It's actually, all it is pressure sensors right here, and then it's calculating the zero moment point, the ZMP. So I'll talk about how it works. So the dynamic stability that we're using are very simple criteria. So the static stability criteria is, you know, you've got the center of gravity of this thing that you can calculate from the configuration. You map it down to sort of the convex hull of the support base, and then you want to try to keep it in the center of that convex hull. So you can take the Jacobian. So if you have this map that maps the location of the center of gravity based on a configuration, you can calculate its derivative and then do some local optimization. Okay? And then the dynamic stability is, so if you've got moment of inertia constraints, the zero moment point is often used right now, very popular in sort of biped walking, where you don't have sort of running or you don't break contact with the ground. If you don't have a flight phase, in other words, you can use these zero moment point constraints to sort of figure out what is the point on the ground in which the sum of all the torques equals zero. And if it's inside the support base, you'll be stable. Okay. Oh, the wobbling? Oh, it's just the cheap actuators. There's so much backlash on the motors. Actually, Sony's robot is absolutely amazing if you see it. The SBR, I think it's going to be sold, they say, at the price of a luxury car. I don't know exactly. They were very successful with the Aibo, but I mean, to me, when I saw that it's about 50 centimeters high, when I saw the dancing humanoid, it was much more compelling than the dog. It looked really good and very fast actuators, and they actually have harmonic drive gears in the knee. They're really tiny harmonic drive gears so that they get zero backlash. Looks really nice. But ours was just a cheap little thing that we sort of put together. So I took this software and I said, well, you know, we're going to try to test it out on this bigger robot. So I made this sort of virtual puppet interface. So now you could sort of try to move the joints and disturb the system, and then it would sort of keep balanced. So you could also tell it, okay, now I want you to balance on the right leg. So it would sort of transition over to balancing on the right leg. And then you could, try to bend the knee and, you know, make him fall over, but he would sort of try to recover, you know, adjust all the other joints to sort of keep him balanced. And then you could sort of switch it back to both legs mode, and then he would sort of come back, and now he's balanced again on two legs. So you get all those constraints. Okay. Yeah, you probably could, but it was using ZMP, yeah. So the motions there were not fast. I mean, they weren't really dynamic, so probably you could do. So then I started thinking, well, can we use this filter and connect it with the planning stuff? So it turns out with a little bit of extra effort, you can actually make this RRT planner that has all these nice convergence properties operate on this constrained space. So instead, before, you know, we just sort of connected a kinematic path. But now we try to generate a kinematic path. It's sort of like that guy that was sort of manipulating the monkey, where the input trajectory violated the constraints, but the output would satisfy them. So we make an incremental motion. So the planner tries to make an incremental motion here, but then that incremental motion is actually filtered through the dynamics filter so that you get something that satisfies the constraints. And then once those are satisfied, you do all your collision checking, make sure there's no collisions, and iterate the planner. And so, yeah, so you find a nearby, and then you sort of, instead of growing sort of just a straight line that might violate the constraints, you try to filter it so that you keep the constraints. So this is sort of how it works. You've got this motion planner, and then the collision checking going on, and then you've got this filter that'll filter all the incremental search motions and pass it back to the motion planner. And then finally, I sort of neglected, sort of glossed over this, but you know, you've got this trajectory in the end that's jerky. Then sort of the same way you sort of tighten slack on a string when you've got, you know, a string connecting two points in a big maze, you can just pull the slack and sort of smooth it out. Here, the smoothing is more complicated because you've got the dynamics. So it turns out you can actually repeatedly filter this whole trajectory using the same filter that we use for each of the small incremental motions. And then what that does is that if you sort of map, I've kind of abused notation here and put sort of the configuration space as this plane and then sort of the velocity or the speed in this plane or in this dimension, you can sort of lift this trajectory up into the, so that it doesn't take as much time. So here you've got sort of velocity zero. That means you're sort of going from zero velocities to zero velocities, sort of jumping between statically stable states. You can actually lift this whole sequence up into the joint space and get one sort of continuous, dynamically stable trajectory. Of course, you have to make sure and check all the constraints, make sure everything's verified. So the first example I looked at for the robot was, well, can I get this guy to, you know, put his leg on this box and keep balanced on one leg? And this was the result of the planner. So I said, well, you know, that looks pretty good. Let's try it on the real robot and see if he falls down. And we were lucky that our dynamic model was good enough, and he managed to execute the motion. I have a funny story. So we were really worried that we didn't have the dynamic properties of this robot right. So one poor graduate student actually spent like 3 months measuring the moments of inertia by hand of the mass and moments of inertia of like 250 parts. And we had this incredibly accurate like dynamic model. And the sad story, or at least the what we learned from this, is that it turned out it didn't matter. Our control system had enough slop in it that you know, our initial guesses of the estimates just were fine and worked just fine. But anyway, that poor student wasn't thrilled to hear that news, but at least we did have a pretty good dynamic model of it. So then we tried on a dual leg example here. Initial pose, the robot standing, the goal pose to sort of grasp this object underneath the table. And this was the motion that was calculated in simulation. And then we tried it out on the real robot. And what we did is added a little bit of extra motion at the end so that he could actually grasp that thing and then play the motion backwards so we could get him to stand up and actually pick it up. So the idea is that you have you know, this task level interface. You can tell the robot, okay, here's an object, pick it up, and then all the motion to actually do that will be synthesized. And the same thing you want to do for an interactive character, an interactive environment in games. Say, you know, right now, if you play Quake Arena or something, you don't see, or Lara Croft doesn't sort of bend down and pick stuff up. You just sort of, she sort of runs over a box of ammo, and then it magically sort of appears in her backpack. So you know, we'd like to get sort of these things interactive and get them, you know, be able to do really sort of dynamic things in these interactive environments. Now I want to mention sort of where I think I see things possibly going, because we're getting really powerful computers and we're getting lots of memory, that maybe we can actually really solve it in the right way. And there's a lot of people in the room here who have done some amazing work in sort of optimal control and really thinking about sort of using physics and really trying to get a control policy to create some animation, synthesize some animation. So in motion planning, in robot motion planning, there's this thing they call kinodynamic planning, where you augment the configuration space with the velocities. That kinodynamic word is kind of a trash word, because people who've been in control know that this is really just a state space, and you're sort of looking at it and saying, well, that's what you do. I mean, everybody knows that. It was just done like control stuff. But anyway, this idea is that you have sort of, it's a little different than simply adding dynamic constraints on a kinematic planner. You're sort of augmenting the space and trying to search in the state space, and you need sort of an incremental simulator. You need this sort of some way of figuring out, well, given my current state and some control that I apply, how does my state change? And once you have this function, then you're sort of searching among the available control inputs. So we did some preliminary experience with my colleague Steve Laval in trying to get sort of dynamic trajectories or kinodynamic trajectories. So here, just the simple example was, okay, let's get this block, but now it has inertia. So you can't just plan a kinematic path. Now you've got to be able to sort of plan based on the control inputs you have. So here's sort of we did the same sort of rapidly exploring random tree search method, but now the trees look a lot different. They're sort of constrained by the fact that you've got some inertia in the system. But you can still do the same thing once you get both of the trees mapped to a state that's the same, then you can connect them up and get a path. And this was sort of our one example that I wanted to show you, is an underactuated spacecraft from one of my favorite movies. The idea is you've got a 12-dimensional state space now. You've got the translation and rotation and all the derivatives. But here we only have 6 control inputs. So it's sort of like a plane. It's the same way. I mean, a plane has these non-holonomic constraints that it can't translate sideways. If you want to go backwards, you actually have to make a big loop. This one can actually roll left and right. It can sort of translate up and down and then speed up and slow down. And that's all that this one can do. But we were able to solve these kinds of complicated problems where you have obstacles in the state space. So now, sort of, I guess to bring it back, this question of, well, now we've got this technology to capture very high fidelity and high details of motion. And for animation, I think for computer graphics, I mean, for robotics, you don't care how the robot picks up the cup, as long as it does it without falling over or killing some graduate student. What you care in graphics is really the quality of the motion. And so that was really what we realized, is that, well, we can do this planning, but it doesn't really look right. It's not really maybe what the animator wanted. And so is there some way of leveraging all these libraries of motion capture data? So I'll just talk about some half-baked ideas that we have right now. And being at CMU, where with Jessica and Nancy and the students at CMU, having all this data available, is there some way to leverage that and combine this planning with physically based simulations, and combine it with the data and extract some knowledge from that data? So I think a hybrid approach is really maybe a solution. I mean, you can think of all the possible ways that a human can pick up something. Is it possible, although Jessica sort of pointed out the interesting sort of surprising thing that very little data seems to span the space of a lot of motions. I mean, you think of this 30-dimensional space, but only 20 ping pong motions or whatever could sort of get a reasonable spanning of that space. How much do you need to span the space of human manipulation? I think Nancy's talk pointed out a lot of those issues, that it seems that you are going to need some kind of model. And is there some way that you can leverage the knowledge gained from the data and to build a model as to how to inform the planner to generate something that's natural or satisfy some aesthetic constraints? So I'll just show you some stuff that, I guess you are the first people to ever see this stuff, that we've been working on together with Katsu Yamane. So it's really Katsu's work who's done all this. He's a postdoc. I met him at the University of Tokyo, and now he's a postdoc for Jessica in our lab. And he's done some interesting work on motion capture and So we've been talking about planning and trying to get sort of data into the planning. Now you're going to have multiple kinematic and dynamic constraints. So here we're trying to do sort of whole body planning, but then sort of doing two-handed manipulations, moving stuff around where you would consider dynamics and consider obstacles. So here there's like a pole here in the middle. And unfortunately, I don't have like the latest version, which the velocity profiles were fixed up quite a bit. But what we did was we planned basically in the space of the box using sort of dynamic programming, but then used a filter sort of similar to the autobalancer filter that I explained earlier in my talk that sort of keeps the center of gravity and also sort of keeps multiple constraints, so keeps the hand sort of grasping the box. And then with a collision checker to check whether or not it's colliding with something. And then the velocity profiles we actually extracted from human data doing that. And there's a lot of problems, so there's a lot of work yet left to be done. And so this is actually the velocities for picking up was actually obtained from a real human who was moving. And it turns out that in the neurophysiology and sort of biomechanics literature, there's this asymmetric bell-shaped velocity curve that people use for manipulating stuff. So it means that, as you grasp it, you sort of accelerate, but then as you get near the target, you sort of slow down. And we're planning in terms of the object space because there's a lot of evidence that that's the way people actually plan manipulation motions. They sort of they move objects in straight lines in the workspace, and it's pretty weird. They did some experiments where they had people sort of given them glasses that distorted the workspace, and they captured their arm motions, and it turned out that they planned them in straight line trajectories as the human saw them, but in the real world they were actually moving in curved trajectories, but at least the person who was moving it saw it as a straight line motion. So there's a lot of evidence that's saying it's sort of this feedback between the hand-eye coordination that's giving you these straight line motions, and somehow the brain is solving this complex inverse kinematics problem to give you really smooth straight line motion in the workspace. So we're trying to do this. We're trying to see if we can extract sort of information from the biomechanical models, extract things about the data, to be able to interactively sort of on the fly generate some complex body motions for arbitrarily shaped objects and doing different tasks. And we'll see where that goes. And if anybody has some good ideas, I'd love to hear some of those. So that's all I had for today. And if there's any questions, I guess I'll stop there. Just to summarize, basically, I believe that increasingly complex human models that we're going to need these automatic generation techniques. I mean, maybe now we're going to have much more sophisticated sort of avatars, things in games. I saw some demos of the latest graphics cards that ATI has, and it's incredible some of the pixel shader things it'll be able to do, real-time sort of physically looking simulations of stuff. I saw some water rippling. It looks really amazing. So that'll, I think, actually, sort of the games industry and interactive entertainment will sort of pound the algorithms people and say, hey, can you generate some good motion? And now we have this really way to render things photorealistically, but the motion looks crappy. So it's kind of a problem, and I think Pixar knows this better than anybody. It's like, they have this great render, but they make movies about bugs and make movies about toys and monsters, because if you try to do, as brought up before, you try to make a photorealistic person, like Final Fantasy or Squaresoft, people pick on the small details. So sort of backing away and doing something more stylized is harder, because the motion generation tools really can't generate things that will satisfy the high standards that people have for human motion. So I believe that probably in the future that there's not going to be one technique that's going to solve it, but some combination of captured motion data, planning, biomechanical models, and some physics will probably be able to solve more of these motion problems, these complicated motion problems. And finally, I think that definitely intelligent virtual robots are likely to be created before intelligent real robots, simply because you can remove all the headache of hardware failures and sensing and errors in control. That we should be able to build sort of a virtual robot that can behave intelligently in a virtual environment, and then hopefully if that works, you know, the hardware will catch up, and then eventually we'll have some machine that will be like C-3PO and sort of make your breakfast or wash your dishes.